This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
KBOO, your community radio station.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for the bike show.
Tune into Between the Covers every Thursday at 11 a.m. to hear interviews with locally and nationally known authors from both fiction and nonfiction. Between the Covers, only on KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at our carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com.
Happy 2013, everyone. I'm Steph Routh. Welcome to the KBOO Bike Show. Today we are joined by special guest Jonathan Mouse, founder and editor of BikePortland.org. The media brings us the news in many forms, in print, on the radio, on television, and permeating the internet, while news organizations from publishers to field anchors describe the world we live in, more and more we see news about the news coverage itself. How does the media shape our view of our world, our political views, and our transportation choices? Bike Portland has in many ways become the lens through which biking in Portland is viewed. Jonathan Mouse founded BikePortland.org in 2005. BikePortland.org is an independent daily news source that covers the Portland bike scene. From the streets to the suits, the blog covers the culture, personalities, projects, businesses, breaking news, and important advocacy issues that define America's arguably most bike-friendly city. Jonathan Mouse, thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
Thanks for inviting me on.
One frequent question that comes up about your site, and actually a lot of independent web-based news sites, is, you know, is it a blog? Is it a media journal? You know, what? How do you define it?
Well, I've actually come upon lately in these last years of not really trying to define it and let other people define it however they'd like. I actually like the fact that it's not doesn't come into a cozy little definition. To start, I used to bristle when people just called it a blog years ago when it was just getting going. In some ways, I was like, no, it's a media source, and you know. And then I figured, you know, fine, call it a blog, whatever you want. I guess it's part of just maturing and realizing that, you know, just because something doesn't fit into the sort of predefined things that people like to put things in doesn't mean that it's a bad thing. And I like not having any definition. It kind of goes with a lot of things on the site, is I think if you have too many rigid rules, then it's harder to break them. And to break them.
Has that conversation conversation about the identity of Bike Portland helped you define it for yourself, what it is?
Yeah, in some ways. I guess it's part of it is wanting to just have the sort of selfish convenience of wearing whichever hat at any time I'd like to wear, that whichever suits the moment, if you will. So maybe I can at some point, you know, sometimes it may suit me to say, oh, it's just a blog. What do you mean? I'm just a guy. I'm just down here in my basement, you know, with my pajamas on, raising a bunch of trouble. And then other times I say, well, what do you mean? You better let me into this meeting because I'm a news source. And how could you discriminate between me and, let's say, some other local news source like the Willamette Week, the Oregonian or whatever. So, yeah, I like to maybe have it both ways, too.
It brings to mind Jon Stewart on The Daily Show once said, you know, I come after a puppet show, people.
Exactly.
So can you talk a little bit about the genesis of BikePortland.org? It started in 2005. I think that a lot of people who bike or, you know, consider biking a central part of their lifestyles now can't imagine a Portland without Bike Portland. But what was it like before?
Well, it started more like a lot of blogs, I guess, sort of more of a personal journal, I guess, of what I was doing and what I was seeing in the local bike scene in Portland. I'd moved here, you know, within a year or so, and I was naturally, since I'm sort of a bike-oriented person, I was out on the streets and meeting people and doing a little bit of volunteering and stuff. And I just replied to an email from the Oregonian, of all places, was looking for people to do these things called blogs on their internet website. And one of the topics they wanted to have a blog for was biking. And, you know, this email list I was on was a biking email list, so it came through. And I saw that and thought, wow, that's something I might be able to do. And so I sent him this really eager, I wish I'd kept the email I replied to because it was so just like eager school kid, like, yes, me, pick me, please, please, please. This is why I could do this. I'd be great. I promise I'll do a good job. It was really funny. So they were, you know, so they let me do that. And I did that for a few months. It was called the Bike Fun blog on the Oregon Live site, which was actually really, it was an amazing start. It was a really great place to start. And I would just like email text to some person that would, then it would magically appear on the internet. But it was the first time where I really was, you know, seeing myself published online like that in that form. And it was also nice because sometimes they would take a story and kind of put it on the front page of OregonLive.com, which is for news, like the number one spot in the whole state. And so that helped build a little bit of an audience early on. And it also was fun to see some of the bike stuff I liked on the front page of OregonLive.com. One of them, the big one I remember, was like bike moves. They put bike moves on the front page of OregonLive.com with like a really, you know, a little picture I'd taken. And I thought that was just so cool. So I did that for a few months. And then I really got into blogging after that. I just sort of dove right into it and started researching them. I was just really geeking out eventually realized that the whole idea of blogging is to not have a middleman. So why would I be writing something so that I'd have to have this middleman of the Oregonian then publish it online? I could do it all myself and have more control. And there was also some functional sort of tools and stuff that the Oregon Live site didn't have that I really want to use. And I was sort of tired of them telling me they may come and they never did. So ended up just one day buying bikeportland.org as a domain name and then finding some free theme on the internet and put it up. And you know, for the first couple of years, I think I paid $6 or $7 in hosting fees and never paid for any design or anything. And I just always marveled at how cheap and easy it was to establish a media source like that. So it just grew from there. It became less and less of a personal blog. And as it grew and the audience grew and people liked it, I did it more. And then I shut down the other business I was doing and devoted myself full time to it, probably in, you know, early 2007, late 2006. And just went full bore and hoped that someday it could be my full-time job.
Wow. And you've continued a relationship with OregonLive.com in some ways in the last year and a half, have you not?
Yeah. Well, recently they had a project where they found blogs and independent journalists sites that they would bring under some sort of umbrella program. They had a grant to do this. And they were going to work together and have this big collaboration with OregonLive.com and collaboration with The Oregonian, and it was going to be this big, happy, awesome thing. So I was one of the first pilot sites that they took on for this new partnership. And it was okay. I did it for the first year. But again, there were some things that I was hoping for that never came to fruition out of that.
Such as?
And, well, one of the big ones were mostly whether or not the partnership was to their benefit or to the partner's benefit. I felt like it was unfortunate that The Oregonian is handled by another corporation that handles their website. So the people at The Oregonian don't have the power to decide what headlines go on the front page of their own site, because those headlines on that site are handled by another corporation, which is, you know, works under OregonLive.com. So it's kind of confusing.
Is that Pamplin?
No, it's Advanced.
Okay.
It's the corporation that's shutting down all these other newspapers around the country and turning them into weeklies instead of dailies and all this stuff. Anyway, so there's all this sort of bureaucracy stuff, and I was just really keen on look, if you want to help independent journalists, if you want to help these local blogs, and you've got to really help them. It's got to be about them. It's got to be get us on the front page. You know, like if there's a breaking story, put Bike Portland breaking story on the front page of OregonLive.com. Then we're working on something. Take some of our excerpts, put them in the paper every morning. You know, let's really do some great stuff and not have all this these barriers in the way to doing things. So when it came time to renew that partnership, I said no thanks. And there was another big part of me leaving that partnership recently, which was I just don't, the general tone and tenor of some of the things Oregonian writes about in my issue, which is transportation and bicycling, I just did not appreciate at all. So it became harder and harder for me to be objective and have a partnership with an organization that I just didn't really like some of the things they were writing.
So that brings to mind, I think, in the intro when we were talking about the role of media and in shaping and framing how we view the things in our lives. And obviously transportation is a huge thing that we view in our lives. Beyond Oregon Live, because I think, the Oregonian is one media source, but there are so many others that come from that. What are some of the larger trends that you see of media organizations shaping us that bicycling is alternative transportation rather than, a viable primary form?
Well, I guess, that happens in a lot of different ways, and I've seen, obviously, since I've been doing Bike Portland, the amount of coverage that bike issues are getting in the local media has really skyrocketed, partly because I've demonstrated to them that there's an audience of people that care about this stuff. And I think,
how big is your audience?
It's hard to say. I don't know, what metric you use. I don't love getting into metrics and stuff, but it's large enough. I like to say there's probably, 18,000 to 20,000 daily readers is how I like to put it. That's all the different ways people access a site, from Twitter to Facebook to getting an email message in their inbox every day on the headlines and all that sort of stuff, to people that come to the homepage. There's a lot of different ways people can grab the news from Bike Portland. But, just to go back to the media thing, it's different. There's such a range. I mean, I think there's obviously still, after all these years, even after all these years of me trying to point out type of bike coverage that I feel is just, inappropriate and inaccurate and not good, that's still happening, unfortunately. I think it's happening less and less, but, these other media corporations are, they're just less sensitive to some of the issues about language use and about how we talk about transportation. And as we know, it's all about us versus them in terms of everything's got to be one team or the other. And that's, it's a story that's what's hurting our national politics and all these other issues that we can't deal with, because the major voices for most of America, these local media outlets, that control so much of the information that's broadcast, it's sort of like their business model to create two teams, and you must choose one of those teams, because it's like, we love that. We love the Super Bowl, you're a Raider fan, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so
we love Western movies.
Yeah, whatever. It's like, how do you create a conflict? And that's what really sells. And I can appreciate that, being someone that's broken news and been publishing a lot of news is, it does sell in a way. I mean, this kind of conflict sells. But you have to look at the bigger picture in terms of there's a lot of other ways to sell news that's not so divisive. And so, yeah, a lot of the local stuff can be divisive, although I think the number one, the volume of stories on bicycling has gone way up. And I do think the sensitivity has gone way up too. But, these are all things that just kind of like you're always working on. And for me, I try to sort of lead by example with the language I use and the way I cover stories, and also try to get to some of the root problems. Like, a lot of people don't understand that the local media takes a lot of what the police says verbatim. They take police press statements as fact, which is not true. It's the police version of the fact. And that's really, really dangerous for a variety of issues, not just when someone, maybe tragically gets hit when they're riding their bike, whatever. So I've been actually working with the police over the years to try to get them to write better statements, so that knowing that the local media is going to take those statements verbatim. And so that's been something I'm super proud of and excited about. I mean, it was a year or so ago when I got a call from the PIO, the information officer for the police, the guy that writes the statements. And those are usually people I know really well because I'm working with them so much. This officer called me because he was about to put out a press release about a bike-related thing that he was worried about the wording, and he wanted to run it by me first to, you know, see what do you think, Jonathan, about how this sounds. Can you take a crack at it or give me some feedback before I press go and send this to all the local media? So to me, I hung up the phone after that. And so we talked about it, and it was really great. And I hung up the phone. I was like, well, that's really fantastic. I mean, these guys care about this stuff. They don't think I'm crazy. And they're willing to hear about how to talk about some of these issues differently so that it minimizes the divisiveness.
That is really awesome. If you are just joining us, we are the KBOO Bike Show and talking with Jonathan Mouse, creator and curator of BikePortland.org. And I want to get back to what you were just talking about, crash reporting and the use of kind of, you know, cutting and pasting. And I think a lot of news organizations have this issue of they're short-staffed. You know, there's a lot of financial constraints in the past few years. And, you know, I think a couple of weeks ago, you and I were emailing back and forth about one crash where they just cut and paste. And we were, neither of us were very happy with that. And we both talked with the PIO. And because it follows a script and there's the playbook that one thing that I see is, you know, that there's this person, this is their age, you know, this is what happened, it was an, you know, this accident, and then, you know, whether or not the driver was cooperating with police, you know, no citation issued, and then, you know, the bulk of, if there's the rest of an article, it's about how this accident has impeded traffic. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, you know, are there... If you were to reframe, like when you, with that conversation with the PIO, what were your suggestions and how do you wish?
Yeah, well, look like? Well, first of all, I wouldn't want to reframe. What I've tried to advocate for with the police is to take all subjective comments out of press statements that the police make. In other words, just the facts that are known at the time. You know, was it snowing, raining, sunny? What time of day was it? What kind of vehicles were involved? What were the basic, maybe the basic movements that, you know, prior to the collision, anything like that? And then maybe, you know, citation information or not. Just keep it really basic. And I said, that's the only way you're going to do that so that activists and advocates don't get upset about, you know, preliminary information that happens. And the response that I've gotten from them is usually, well, the media ask us. People want to know. When something happens, people want to know. So we're just doing our job and trying to tell them what they want to know. And I'm like, you're in control. You should be in control of your information. You can decide whether people have the right to know at that time or not. And coming out and saying, we believe speed was a factor in a collision, right? When people are grieving, when people are sad, when the community is upset about what happened, and you're saying things like you believe, you know, speed was a factor or some other aspect, or who was at fault, or so-and-so ran a stoplight, or so, you know, the police don't know those things at the time they write these statements. They don't know them as a matter of fact. They're going by their own judgments and hunches, if you will. Sure. But what happens, as we see, is it gets used verbatim, and then it's spun. The spin starts happening immediately, and people are upset and fighting with each other and blah, blah, blah. So I think the best way to you know, make that better is to just take out, at least from the police, take out any kind of embellished information or any kind of like in speculation or hunches in these press statements. I think that would be the best thing. But in particular, like you asked about the one statement I mentioned earlier, you know, my big thing is to not divide people by what type of transportation they use. I think that is just it's a small step that people can take, and it's just the impact of it is inherently negative one. Because unfortunately, that's like the starting part of how we start to blame and accuse and stereotype people based on how they get around. So, you know, in that one statement, it was a guy on a motorcycle who had a passenger on the Hawthorne Bridge and had jumped the curb and hit someone else that was biking. So the headline actually ended up being pretty clunky because, you know, I was saying, you know, man on a motorcycle, you know, crashes on Hawthorne Bridge and hits another man riding a bicycle. It's not very easy to say necessarily. But that's kind of stuff we're working through. But I think it's really important to do, you know, people first language. I think is super important to try to do. If we're handling the information, all we can do is try to give it to the public in a way that is the most responsible way that minimizes conflict and division. And I think one of the best ways to do that is to just talk about people first and not this bicyclist thing where you're sort of like
a
person buying a bicycle. And it started for me really as a personal experience where a friend of mine was tackled and tased while he was riding his bicycle. And it was just a really ugly incident. And I found myself hearing about this information, putting a story together in my head. And it just didn't seem to do it justice by writing a headline, "Bicyclist Tackled and Tasered by Police." There's just something about that that was inhuman. It just didn't feel good, you know? So that was the first headline I remember where I wrote, "Man on a Bicycle Tackled and Tasered." It may sound like a small thing to some listeners, but the bigger picture of that, I mean, it actually does have a really big impact to start talking about the person and the way they got around as sort of a secondary thing. And many times the way people get around is not even really important to the story. That's another level of sensitivity and consciousness about this, is we've all assumed that it's important that we know how they were getting around, but that could be some vestige of sort of this, you know, discriminatory sort of outlook we all have around this stuff. A lot of times it's just people moving around the city and they have these conflicts, you know. So I'd like to kind of peel back all that stuff and say, you know, to what extent can we get rid of some of the controversy by just talking about people moving around a city and not the fact that, oh, they're a bicyclist or they're a motorist. And, you know, it's also a personal thing in the sense that I don't identify as any of that stuff. You know, I have a minivan. I drive it around sometimes. I just drove to California and back for the holidays on the freeway all over the place. But I'll also ride my bike a lot. I mean, so how would I fit into that? You know, if I got hurt or if I was in the news and I wasn't, you know, Bike Portland guy, would they just call me bicyclist? And would that really sum up who I am or what I am or what I believe? You know, so I like to look beyond that.
In my other hat, as you know, I'm executive director of Now Oregon Walks, which was the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition. One of the reasons was, you know, no one identifies as pedestrian because it's synonymous. It's become synonymous with banal, you know, or humdrum, and that everyone walks. It's like breathing. It's like, as Michael Colvin Anderson says, you know, it's like a vacuum cleaner. Right. You know, where I think, as you've said, you want. We want bicycling to go. It's a vacuum cleaner. It's a broom. It's, you know, one of those tools that you use in your everyday life. I do want to come to, and I think this comes to the conversation about polarization that you've said, you know, let's get rid of this bike community idea. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if that statement is somewhere part and parcel with that desire to get away from polarization.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a part of that. I mean, anything people can conveniently pigeonhole and stereotype, I think we should work to rewind and unwind, you know? And that's certainly the bike community. You hear that from local media or anybody. It's like the bike community. You can hear it from a hater saying the bike community does this or that, or they need to do this or that better. As if we're all, you know, standing in one room and there's someone up on stage telling us what to do, and we're also part of some club or union or something. Like, it's just not, there's no basis of that in reality. But obviously there is a community. I mean, so instead of the bike community, I'll say more, you know, there's a community of people that care about this issue and that issue. Why put bike in there? Why does the bike have to be a big part of that? You know, or there's a community of people that ride bicycles, or a lot of people in our community care about issues, including bicycling, blah, blah, blah. So it's just a different way of framing it.
If you are just joining us, we are the KBOO Bike Show and are joined here today with curator and creator of BikePortland.org, Jonathan Mouse. One question I do have, because I'm executive director of an organization that is based on a movement of people who don't identify as, you know, people don't identify as walking. And so activism has been, it's been more difficult to identify, to rally behind, and to develop momentum for. So I just wonder, is to what extent do we want to dismantle bike community if that activism of that identity and that movement is helping bicycling become more possible for more people?
Well, first, I would argue that we have to be willing to consider that it's not helping that identity. That identity is not helping. That identity of bike community feels good for people that identify like that, but that's it. It doesn't feel good to everybody outside those who identify like that, right? So I think that's important. We could have a conversation about, is it working? Is it helping? Mm-hmm. How many people are biking? How many could be biking? A lot of people aren't because they don't see themselves as bicyclists because they're not a member of the bike community.
And yet people who do see themselves as the bike community do testify, you know, in Salem. So,
people that care about these issues testify in Salem. They're caring about whatever issue or ever value that is related to the fact that they ride a bicycle. They're only testifying as a member of the bike community by the people that call them a member of the bike community, or they themselves identify themselves like that, and that's up to them to identify themselves any way they'd like. But we're having more of a sort of a philosophical conversation about what might be the best way to go about it, or what are the merits of always focusing on this identity. And advocates are guilty of it too, because that identity equals excitement. That identity equal. I mean, you identify as something, you want to pay into it, you want to donate to it, you want to become a member of it, and that's how advocacy groups survive. So they have a real interest in making sure that identity stays there to some degree. It's important to, I think about the fact that, I use the word selfish a lot in terms of the bike community. It's similar how I feel like sort of, ghost bikes and the rite of silence, right? For people that identify as bicyclists and identify as members of the bike community, it's thing that really feels good to them to memorialize and talk about that kind of stuff. But to people outside of that, you know, is that really achieving a good thing to be focusing on the fact that someone died doing this activity, right? It feels good for the people that are in the movement, but what is the signal it's sending outside the movement? And I'm always just trying to check that relationship. Is what we're doing in the movement, let's say, it may feel good to us, but is it achieving our goals? Is it really doing the stuff we need to do, which is sort of break down these walls and these silos of being in a movement and making it so that the entire community believes in these values and wants to be a part of this movement. Mm-hmm.
I think you hit on something really great, which is, this idea that I kind of wonder the ghost bike phenomenon, which I think is in some ways really important and restorative, and bringing people together. But, is someone who has died on a bicycle any more tragic than someone else who has died on a road, like in a car, right? Even if it's a single collision crash. One thing, just coming back to, you're talking about the spin of reporting, and cutting and pasting. A lot of initial spin is in the comments section, and I know that you've struggled with your comment section. And what do you feel is what has been your struggles with the comment section generally?
Well, I guess trying to foster a good dialogue it's always a struggle when you have such an open system. I see my role and I see the site. I kind of go back to like the Greek agora, where you have the entire community coming together in a plaza and discussing an issue. It's messy. Who has the right to stand up on the rock and talk to all the people, and how do you control who says what without getting in fights? I mean, it's not a clean thing. And I don't try to make it clean either. I think that's what offends people, is that I'll let comments go that are messy comments, or ones that some people may not feel good about. My goal isn't to create a space where everybody feels good necessarily, because that's a level of perfection that I know is not attainable. So I'm not going to struggle over that. And I also think messiness and feeling not good is part of how you move forward. So you have to hear alternative voices. And I think a lot of these advocacy-related sites, or at least people in sort of my sphere, they get upset when they hear viewpoints that aren't theirs. Especially if it's, a controversial viewpoint that is actually the viewpoint of the other side, so to speak. And then it's like they're called a troll because they don't believe or they don't talk in the same way that the majority of people talk on the site. And I one of my rules, I don't have any rules published, right? So so that I can break them and set them any way I want at any time. And one of the sort of rules I have in my head when I'm looking at comments is no one can call anyone a troll except me. but no one's allowed to do that, because they don't know, what are the comments that person's left. I may know that. They don't know the kind of context of what that person says. So, yeah, I mean, it's always a struggle when you have a high volume of people leaving comments. And it's just something that, I also don't have any verification system. Although people can't sock puppet, which means they can't create usernames and have a discussion with each other, that's like instantly all your stuff gets deleted. I do have some rules. I mean, I have certain words that are going to get you blacklisted. I do hold people's comments. There's some people who have all their comments held back before they're published, people that just have not been nice, and they're sort of on the bad kid list, but for the most part, it's kind of a wild frontier, in the sense that I will let semi-controversial stuff stand if I feel like it's going to have ultimately a good impact on everybody hearing everybody's viewpoints. But it's not perfect, and it's also impossible to moderate all of them when it gets hot and heavy and I got a lot of things I'm going on.
And I think some people forget, because, you know, the internet is, of course, ubiquitous, that you are bikeportland.org. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, I've had people working closely with me as employees from time to time over the years. At this point, I haven't had anybody working with me. So, and that's another part of sort of said in the beginning of wanting to wear different hats when it suits me. You know, sometimes it's important for people to understand that it's a serious website. It's a very serious news outlet. I take it very seriously. It's very professional, has a lot of credibility, all this stuff. But in other times, like when comments get out of control and maybe someone's upset, I'll go back and say, hey, it's just me. Just a guy with a site. Like, you know, have a little bit of breathing room here. Give me some time to get control of these comments. I gotta take some time out to do this, because, you know, over here I was selling ads, or I had to do this family thing and I didn't have time to look at these comments. So, but that's hard for people to understand too, because they go to the site, they see all the ads, they think it's this big successful media empire, and it has been around for 7 years. So they start to think that I must have staff and there must be people. So that creates
this huge media conglomerate.
Yeah, exactly. It creates this expectation, you know, and when that expectation isn't met, people get upset. So I have to kind of like, you know, rejigger that expectation and say, hey, it's just me. I'm just doing as good a job as I can do.
Right. You are listening to the KBOO Bike Show, and we've been talking with special guest Jonathan Mouse, creator of Bike Portland.
Riding fast and riding slow, riding with nowhere to go. On my bicycle, 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 bicycle. Up the slope and down the hill, with the hair in the wind is such a thrill. On my bicycle, 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 bicycle. Rusty old lorries, it's like the world has ended, but I'm not sorry. On my bicycle, 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 bicycle. Everything gets returned back to Mother Nature, better sooner rather than later. You could say.
Are listening to the KBOO Bike Show, and we've been talking this whole hour with special guest Jonathan Mouse, creator and curator of BikePortland.org. In the last half hour, we've been talking a little bit about the role of media and the role of Bike Portland in transportation media news. I want to shift focus just a little bit, especially, I would say, in the last few years, I've seen you report more and more on, you know, the city hall, the kind of inner workings of transportation policy. Mayor Adams has just left the mayorship and left city hall. He's been our transportation commissioner and then our mayor and still transportation commissioner for, what, I think 12 years. So what, you've covered him pretty extensively. So what is, if you were to do a retrospective of the last 12 years, this could probably take up the next half hour. Jonathan, go.
Yeah, right. A retrospective of Sam's tenure. Wow. I have a lot of mixed feelings about all that and about his tenure. I think you know, I'm going to be dealing with some of that on the site in the next, you know, week or so, because it's one of those things that I have to share on the site or else it'll just torment me forever. but, you know, it's a lot of mixed feelings. I mean, obviously, the guy is a real transportation wonk. I mean, he got that issue. He cared about that issue of transportation and how bicycling fit into that. But I think ultimately, you know, it was sort of a missed opportunity. I think, and, you know, when he came into office, when he came into being mayor, I just think about the excitement and enthusiasm around, you know, people in my world that, you know, really care about biking. And I don't think any of them can honestly say it was met in terms of what they had hoped for, that expectations were not met. You know, that excitement never materialized into actually things on the street.
Do you think it could have been met?
Absolutely. I think if his scandal didn't happen, it would have been met without a doubt. And I think that changed everything when he came into office and was just, you know, just absolutely, you know, hitting the kneecaps in the sense of this scandal. I mean, it was a body blow to the city. It's certainly a body blow to a lot of people that cared about bicycling, knowing full well that, for better or for worse, he'd been labeled as the bicycling mayor. So if that's an issue you care about and your mayor has just lost all power and all credibility, it's kind of a big deal. And obviously, he's an amazing politician in a lot of ways. He's very smart. He's very dedicated. He works very hard. And he has a lot of good ideas. But even though, because of that, he was able to, you know, recover from that scandal, it still played a huge role in the issues that were sort of minority issues for him, biking being one of those, right? I mean, so it just totally inhibited him from being strong on bicycling. I think ultimately it made every time he opened his mouth around bicycling, the local media just, you know, just came right in on it. They had some missteps from their own office in City Hall and from the Bureau of Transportation that led to some controversy, both messaging missteps and project missteps. So, you know, you're relatively early in his administration being mayor, there was a lot of controversy around biking. So you couple that with the fact that there are a lot of people in local media that wanted him to go, and that they used bicycling as the sort of the thing to hit him with, because that was one of his pet issues. And that combination of factors, that sort of political social dynamic, was never really fixed. And I think because he stayed in office, it made people like the Oregonian, which is arguably the most powerful voice in the local and statewide media, but local since we're talking about Portland, they're just so bitter that he stayed around and they just don't like him. You know, I think bicycling was an easy way for them to get at Mayor Adams. So unfortunately, if you care about bicycling, you know, tough luck, you know, you suffer. And then we saw that repeatedly. And a lot of stuff in this city that's going wrong ended up getting blamed on bicycling because it was a way for the community to express their anger for Sam Adams and his scandal or the fact that they didn't like his leadership or whatever. And I think that's absolutely true. You know, when you have this is years ago, you had a bunch of really unfortunate, terrible, tragic gang shootings up in North Portland. And I forgot, someone came to town, a national civil rights leader came to town. I think it was 2008 summer. And there was a woman in a Baptist church up in North Portland that yelled at the mayor, "Well, there's blood in your bike lanes." You know, meaning that the idea is that because he's sitting there, you know, striping a bunch of bike lanes and talking to all the bike people and the bike community and all the whatever, quote unquote, bicyclists, because he's so focused on bicycling, you know, kids in North Portland are and there's a bunch of gang violence going on, right? I mean, that's the level of sort of blame that bicycling was taking in this city. But that's just one example of you know, a big trend that was happening where people were expressing their anger. So I think, you know, that played a big role in his lack of ability to, I think, really do some exciting, bold things for biking. I mean, people on the outside of the sort of bike movement, if you will, hear me say that and they're like, "What are you talking about? You gotta be kidding. Look at all the biking stuff they're doing." But, you know, that's another problem that us advocates and people that care about bicycling have to deal with, is there's a really misperception in the greater community here in Portland of how much is going on for bikes. You know, every time Mayor Adams did anything for bikes, it was a press release. It was a big, you know, they tried to kind of make a big deal about it because he wanted to play into the whole "I'm a biking mayor" thing. So there's like a disproportionate understanding in the community about how much is really going on. And I would challenge anyone to convince me that Mayor Adams did something super amazing for bicycling while he was in office. I certainly don't know what it was. People have to understand, in Portland, given the momentum we had before he got to the mayor's office, doing what he has done, finding money for biking, doing the neighborhood streets that we do, doing some projects here and there. That's not, I think, that's to be applauded, and that's great, but it's certainly not a step up. And I think this town for years has been ready for a big step up. We've got the groundwork laid. I mean, we've been, you know, Bud Clark, Earl Blumenauer, or Mia Burke. I mean, we have the groundwork laid here. We had a mayor who basically ran on doing amazing things for bikes, and it kind of fell flat, if you will. I don't see these big things. I mean, I rode over to the studio on the Burnside Bridge. You know, that's a 1990s bike lane, Burnside Bridge. It's a major connection into downtown. So there's not one major project that I think is like, wow, Sam really came through and did something amazing that shook the status quo of transportation in this city around, you know, regarding biking.
I kind of two questions, environmental questions around that, because I, right about that time, about 2008, you know, something else happened, and that was, you know, a pretty significant recession, and that affected transportation funding possibilities. And last year, you know, we saw $20 million have to leave the Bureau of Transportation. This year, they're looking at $4.5 million. You know, we're seeing the federal transportation reauthorization just gut, in many ways, bike and ped infrastructure possibilities. So, and you also have, you know, that inevitable backlash. So I'm just wondering if there's, you know, when you rise enough to power, you know, there is that kind of tamping down a little bit, you know, wanting to pull someone back or transportation options back. So I'm wondering, to what extent do you think that might have factored into the lost expectations?
You mean the funding picture, how that might have impacted it?
Yeah, funding and generally just a, was it time for a backlash?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think, I would never think it would be time for a backlash. I think, you know, the funding picture and the recession and all that stuff, the economic collapse, if you will, to me, I see that as it's another opportunity to reframe the dialogue and to fundamentally change how people think about their streets. You can choose to hide behind the lack of funding to say you can't do this thing over here or whatever. Or you can say, look, now we've got to be really judicious about how we spend our money. And I know, because I just know, I'm the mayor, that you know, investing differently in our streets is what we need to do, because there's other ways of moving around that are a lot more economically viable and less expensive than the old way. I mean, so that could have started a huge conversation about, you know, re-engineering our streets. And you know, when I brought this up to Sam and we sat down a couple years ago for a big interview, he was really defensive and upset that I would say, you know, where's the real major bikeway downtown that connects us, you know, some houses down to downtown that's just not there. And he got really upset. And, you know, it's not a matter of, you know, it's more a matter of, so he was saying, well, look, there's this project over here, but there's nothing that is really connecting people, you know, like a street does, let's say. And it was also a matter of, you know, going back to that excuse of funding. And it's like, well, it doesn't have to be expensive. And he kind of put it, Sam also put it back on me as if to say, oh, sorry, you know, there's a sidewalk in East Portland, or there's these other priorities we have. We can't do this, you know, bike tunnel over the river due to downtown. He put it back on me like that. And it's really not a matter of some huge expensive project. I'm not talking about some air-conditioned bike path that cost $100 million.
That's Dubai.
Yeah, right. We have streets in the city that could be relatively cheaply redesigned in order to vastly improve the access for people that want to ride their bikes. That's just the bottom line. Mm-hmm. That's a fact. It's not an activist or an advocate saying that. That's just the fact. We could redesign a lot of streets, you know, with very little money, to really make them much more balanced, so that the tens of thousands of people in Portland, America's number one bike-friendly city, that want to ride their bikes, they can do it. Now, it doesn't take a lot of money, so the money excuse is really, it's viable in some regards, doing some projects, but it's not the end of the conversation. So someone like Mayor Adams would say, well, in order to do those redesigns, you need to have enough political, you need to have the political ability to do that, which means you have to have the community on your side. You've got to have, you know, these other groups that don't want it are going to get upset. So how do you work that dynamic? And that's obviously complicated, but I've always thought that the leadership to accomplish those kind of things starts from the mayor's office, or it could start from the mayor's office. So there's this dance where Mayor Adams would say, hey, I need more support from advocates in order to do the stuff you're asking me for. And then someone like me to say, well, it'd be great if you kind of put out a little bit of strength around these issues to help rally that support. So like, what comes first? A visionary mayor who's going to be committed to a goal around this thing a lot of people care about, right? Or a community that's going to say, hey, we want all that stuff, you know, like, which, and that's kind of a thing that the community has to think about. But, you know, I didn't hear, there was nothing like that. I mean, look at what Rahm Emanuel's doing in Chicago. Look what New York's doing. Look at San Francisco's doing. They have these short-term goals. You know, I don't know, Chicago's is, 100 miles of protected bike lanes in 10 years or something like that. I mean, you know, Sam made one promise when he came into office, there would be a cycle track downtown, you know. What they put in was a second choice compromised cycle track next to Portland State that doesn't connect to anything and that's never been redesigned or improved upon in 4 years. And that's the only protected, you know, section we have downtown, the only one. So, you know, there's not a lot of there wasn't a real vision put on the table. And the Portland Bike Plan for 2030, sure, he passed that under his tenure. But that's a planning document. You know, it's a 30-year time horizon or a 20-year time horizon. It's not really something that's going to get the community excited about, you know, and it's not something that comes up a lot in terms of their planning and stuff as it is. It's just a thing. And obviously, it's an unfunded mandate, which gets to one of the main controversies that really, you know, hurt these last 4 years was this whole $600 million bike plan, which obviously is untrue. And it's another one of the messaging things that the mayor's office never really fully recovered from and never was able to really manage properly. And it hurt. It hurt bicycling to have those kind of controversies. It was one of many. So, you know, I have sort of mixed feelings about you know, Mayor Adams' tenure because I think that in a lot of ways it was a missed opportunity to really continue some exciting momentum. And it introduced a lot of unnecessary controversy into bicycling. But at the same time, you know, there were some good basic fundamentals in terms of fighting for some set-aside money, which is important. Although, you know, I always want it to be more and to be fought for differently, I guess. But it's there. And he made a real point about transportation safety, which I think is important. And, you know, to his credit, he had a transportation safety summit every year. And those were great events to get the community involved with the city staff and all that sort of stuff. So those are great things. Now, so whether or not, you know, to what extent there's some continuity there and what sort of vision or way Mayor Charlie Hales, new Mayor Hales, will take, obviously remains to be seen. But I think because of the way that bicycling has been politicized and unfortunately made controversial under Sam's tenure, it's hurt, I think, Mayor Hale's ability to sort of really grab it and go. It's going to take some rebuilding, I think, for him to really do the right thing and to have the kind of conversation we need to have around transportation.
If you are just joining us, we are the KBOO Bike Show, and joining us today is curator and creator of BikePortland.org, Jonathan Mouse. Going to the future, actually, if you were, you know, there's a new mayor, there are a couple of new commissioners, and one of those Charlie Hales has already said that he will not be taking transportation, so it will be up to, you know, one of the other commissioners that we'll find out probably in a few months. If you were there, if you had their communication staff in a room, what do you think are the possibilities of bicycling policy and infrastructure over the next 4 years? And what does City Hall need to do? What do news organizations, mm-hmm. how do they need to start framing it differently to get over this polarization? And what does the community need to do?
Well, that's a lot to...
yep. Well, we have 12 minutes.
Those are a lot. That's a lot of stuff to get to. I think, you know, the funny thing is now, for years, Portland was always the leader, right? So we just loved sort of this feeling that everybody was looking up to us and we were the innovators and leaders around biking. And so that, and I think that reached a point of where it was a bad thing because we sort of rested on our laurels. And the funny thing is now, the good thing for Mayor Hales and his staff is that we're not the leaders, so we can look to other cities to see what they're doing and use them for advice and to see how they're moving forward in their cities. And like I mentioned before, there's a couple of them, mostly New York, and, you know, Chicago's doing some good stuff. But, I mean, I would take the same frame as New York does. I mean, I spent a couple weeks there back in October, November, and got to see, how they're doing it. And it's a real back to basics kind of thing. It's, and like, that's what I said before, this isn't about, you know, activists or critical mass or we need to do more, but it's just a basic thing. The streets are outdated. They need to be brought up to speed. We can't afford to do them like we do them, you know, have we been doing them. You know, the great way that the commissioner, Transportation Commission of New York talks about it is saying, you know, if you run a business and you don't change for 60 years, you're not going to be in business. You'll be bankrupt, right? You will be dead. And that's what we do on our streets in a lot of ways, is they're the same streets. They just sit there in the same way. So in New York, they're bringing their streets up to date. And it's also, you know, there's some basic, I go back to the word basic all the time. It's, I mean, it's a basic safety message. It's about, look, you know, there's people being hurt on our streets, then they would be a lot safer if we rebalanced them a little bit, brought speeds down, you know, restricted auto use here and there, and, you know, just got them rebalanced, create more public space, more, you know, that sort of thing. And it's just, I mean, in general, in terms of, you know, Mayor Hill's staff and thinking about bicycling, don't be the biking mayor. You know, don't be like looking for little bones to throw to, quote unquote, the bike community. Just do the right thing. I mean, the research is there. The advocates are there. There are smart planners in this city. All the evidence is there that the streets are not doing the right thing and that we need to balance them a little bit for different types of vehicles to access them. And so just do it, really. I mean, it's a basic service the city needs to provide right now. There are many, many, many thousands of people in this city who, by making the choice to get on a bike and enter the roadway, are putting themselves at undue risk, right? And not only that, but there's thousands and thousands of people that won't even put themselves in that position because they're afraid of that risk, right? So for me, it's a basic rights thing of those streets that the city is, you know, by law, supposed to be providing for us. That service is not being provided to the level it should be. So that needs to be fixed. And I think with that kind of tone, you know, given that Mayor Hills has some experience with transportation and he knows kind of how to do it, I think, in some ways, I think they could get a lot done. I mean, like I said before, the fundamentals haven't changed. We've built an amazing base in this town for moving forward in a really awesome, amazing way for bicycling. And all that structure and fundamentals are pretty much all still intact. We're just waiting for the right mix of leadership, both in the community and in City Hall, to make that happen and start getting our groove back again, so to speak. And I think we've lost it for these last couple of years. So I'm looking forward to that.
So what do you think advocates need to be doing?
Well,
what do I need to be doing, Jonathan?
Well, that's a really good question. I think, you know, what advocates need to be doing is, you know, education and, you know, just reaching as many people as possible and reaching as many people as possible to have them understand how the values that they already have inside themselves are aligned with the things that, you know, advocates like yourself around walking and, you know, the bike advocates align with those same values that you guys care about too. You know, that's how I look at bicycling, not as an activist or something, but it's like, I know that the values associated with this activity are just great things. It's great for urban, city, dense areas. It's great for neighborhoods. It's great for, I mean, it's awesome stuff. And, you know, because when you're biking, you're connecting with people. I mean, we can go through the whole litany of reasons why it's great. But everybody should, you know, kind of come in under that tent, if you will. So I think the role of advocates is to, you know, open that tent up, get as many people under it, and let's start talking about this stuff, because this isn't an issue where I think, you know, I have to win an argument. I mean, it's like, the argument's won. I mean, it's there. We just need to talk about it with more people, and it sort of wins itself. It's so obvious.
You know, I think the greatest moment of advocacy I ever had was getting my mom on a bicycle, who hadn't been on her bicycle since she was in high school.
Right.
And I think it was about 5 years ago she got on, and she was like, I needed to be read, I needed to be comfortable, and I need to be safe. You know, and she's now a retired nursing professor. And, you know, when she goes to Curves, when she was going to Curves in outer East Portland, where I grew up, she would come in and she'd be like, you know, there is no place for me to park my bicycle. There's no stables. Wherever am I to park it?
Right.
And, you know, sure enough, you know, they quickly had a policy in that Curves, you know, and that anyone who's riding a bicycle can just wheel it right on in. And I was like, I think I might be able to retire.
That's funny. Yeah. So I think creating, you know, creating people that care about this, getting people to understand why it's good. And then you create your own army of advocates, so to speak. But I also think in terms of advocacy groups, it's really important for them to, you know, hold leadership accountable to what they're doing, and what, most importantly in this town, is to sort of what maybe they're not doing quickly enough, and be careful who your friends are. I mean, this town has evolved so much with bicycling, and some of these advocacy groups are so tied in with the power structure that it's hard for them to then go to the power structure and say, hey, we're unhappy with you. Especially hard to do that publicly, which I think sometimes is important to do. So I think it's important for advocacy groups. I mean, mostly the BTA, since they're sort of the big bike advocacy group in town. They've been around quite a long time. They have a good sized staff. They have a lot of resources at their disposal. And I think they can leverage that into really smart, strategic, holding of feet to fires. You know, I think that's super important. And they've made a decision to really not be that sort of aggressive kind of that kind of advocacy. They're doing a little different style of advocacy, which is also great. And so that's something for the community to think about in terms of, you know, what tone do we want to take about talking about this stuff? How can the community and the members of the BTA help maybe, you know, get them to be a little more forceful and doing a little more sort of watchdogging and less, you know, cheerleading and you know, looking at the people they're supposed to be holding accountable, looking at them as partners, partly, but also as, you know, maybe a little more distance there and saying, hey, if you don't do what we want you to do, then there's going to be some consequences. I mean, that sort of old school advocacy needs to really, I think, come back a little bit in Portland. And I think we've seen that in the biking world to some extent, and also in a broader context, you know, like with the CRC debate, where there's really nobody really stepping up and saying, hey, that's not okay. We're going to rally the troops and we're going to show you that the people don't want this thing. And, you know, you're going to pay politically unless you start talking about it differently or taking a different direction. So maybe that comes back in these next, you know, in this next term with Mayor Hills, because the dynamic changes. I mean, that's what was tricky about the Sam Adams era, is that he was seen as a friend of the biking sort of world in this town and the people that care about biking, and certainly the bike advocacy groups. Me personally, I saw him as a pretty close, you know, partner and working on stuff, mm-hmm. because, you know, he believes in doing bike stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that made it really hard to advocate and watchdog, because, you know, you have that different relationship. So I think with Mayor Hills, I'm actually looking forward to not having a friend in City Hall in the same way that I had a friend in Mayor Adams. You know, and I say friend, but I mean, you know, someone who would come to events and I could chat with, and, you know, we could talk on the phone, right, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, with Hales, we've already not started out as being as good of a relationship as I had with Sam when he came in. So I'm actually looking forward to that. I think it's healthier overall for the city to have, when you have a media person like myself, an advocacy journalist, and also hopefully advocacy groups, when you have a little more of a distance between the power at City Hall. And it's not about critical mass and throwing your ULOC through someone's windshield and being all crazy and calling them out in the media. It's about just being strategic pressure. It's about being smart, not letting leadership off the hook, and holding their feet to the fire and saying, hey, this stuff hasn't happened. Why? We'd like some answers. If those answers aren't the right answers, then we're going to continue to press, and we may have to go public and let people know that you're not living up to your promises.
And I think that you're teeing up a conversation that we should have in a future show, which is different advocacy styles, you know, mm-hmm. that you have collaboration, mm-hmm. you know, between advocates and leadership, and which gets a lot done that doesn't get into the media. Mm-hmm. I think that there are a lot of, just to shout out a tiny bit of love for I think there are some wins that were kind of the avoidance of disaster that never right. really get talked about.
Right.
And you can't really point to as saying, hey, that didn't happen.
Right.
I do want to ask one question before, because we're running out of time. Have you ever thought of elected office?
I've thought about it, yeah. And then I've thought it's not the right thing for me.
Why?
Well, for one thing, I kind of have a one-track mind in some regards, and maybe that's because just professionally I've had to for these last 7 years. And that, you know, obviously I just see the world through a biking sort of lens, at least my civic sort of world. And so I'm not necessarily well-rounded, so I'd have to take a crash course in a lot of other issues, I think. But no, I think partly is because I think the major reason why I've sort of not thought very long about it is I've worked with these people that are, you know, with elected officials. I have a tremendous amount of respect for what they have to go through. And I've had small experiences of that, of going through that same thing when you're a public figure and you're just unfairly maligned, or you're held to certain expectations, you know, all these things, enough so that I can appreciate that I would never want that to the extent of an elected official. You know, it's a very, very difficult job. You know, I also have three young kids. So I have a boy who's going to be 2 years old in the next couple of months, and I have a 7.
You could be your chief of staff.
Yeah, right. So, you know, it's a pretty, in some ways, it's a thankless job, and I still have work to do doing what I'm doing now.
Well, thank you for doing it. You've been listening to the KBOO Bike Show. We're on the air the first Wednesday of every month. Our show is generously edited by Josh Hetrick and archived by Portland Transport, online at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. You can also find recent episodes free on iTunes. The Bike Show is produced by Tori Bortman, Michelle Poirot, and myself, Steph Routh. We'd also like to thank our in-studio engineer today, Kathleen Stevenson, covering for Kurt Lauer, underestimate her awesomeness at your peril. We'll be back next month with more news and views from the bike world. Work hard, be happy, and ride your bike, people. And Jonathan, thank you very much again for being on the show today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Steph.
Listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM in Hood River in the Gorge, 100.7 FM in Corvallis in Albany. That's K220HR Hood River, K264AA Corvallis. And it's time for Jazz Lives. My name's Nick Geffro, and away we go.
Ha ha ha.